So, we come to verse 6 and 7, which are one unit. So, let's recite verse 6. Yastu sarvani bhutani atme vabhuti sarvabhuteshu chatmanam. Tato na vijugupsate. Translation.
He who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being.
Yes. So the connection with the previous verse is that the previous two verses described how the absolute truth has inconceivable aptitudes. And to develop the vision for seeing the absolute truth properly, we need to first develop a proper vision for the world around us. You know, Srila Prabhupada says that all knowledge comes from Krishna, but all knowledge doesn't begin from Krishna. That means, mattah smritir jnanam apohanam cha. Or knowledge comes from Krishna. But as far as our individual knowledge is concerned, it doesn't begin from Krishna. First we look at the world around us and think of the world and see what does it mean. Try to find some underlying patterns beneath the observations that we make. So, all knowledge comes from Krishna, but it does not begin from Krishna. It begins from the world. So, same applies with spiritual knowledge also. That we don't directly start understanding Krishna. We start understanding the world around us. So, getting a spiritual vision towards the world involves getting a spiritual vision towards the people of the world, to the individuals of the world. So, here it is said that these people who have this vision, we know from the Bhaktisamasindhu point of view, as well as for the Udishavati point of view, they are in three levels. Kanishta, Madhyama, Uddama. Now, in the Indian knowledge systems, whether it is Vedic, the Vaishnava tradition or Mayavad, knowledge, Jnan, is always connected with Adhikar. Adhikar means, like we have the word Adhikari. Adhikar means qualification. So, knowledge is always a function of qualification. If one doesn't have the qualification, one cannot acquire the knowledge. And that means, now from the simplest level, if you want to look at it, we can say that, you know, a girl who is not yet attained puberty, she cannot know what is pregnancy. Similarly, a man who has not yet attained puberty, he cannot know what is the sexual drive. There may be some background attraction. So the point here is that this is a very gross and materialistic example, but which illustrates the point that for certain things to be understood, certain amount of maturity has to be achieved. So, from a literal point of view, from a more conventional point of view, you can say that a junior college student cannot really understand doctorate level calculus. So, we understand this normally in the educational field. We also understand it in the biological field. But people expect that no such qualification is required in the spiritual field. But spiritual field also involves growth. So, what does this growth actually involve? Well, just as a person grows old biologically, a child may be fascinated with toys. But as he grows up, he loses the fascination with the toys. So similarly, as a person grows spiritually, he starts seeing the sense objects and the material varieties of this world to be as insubstantial as toys. Basically, that means as a person grows spiritually, he outgrows sensual pleasures. It's not that he resists them by force. It's not that the child has to be wrenched from the toys by the parents. Once or twice they may have to do it. But as the child grows, automatically he loses the fascination with the toys. So one of the symptoms of spiritual advancement is that we are no longer fascinated by material varieties and material forms and material sense objects. And that is when a person can develop spiritual vision. So, of course, initially there is a struggle where we have to resist and reject the sense objects consciously. But as we grow up, for example, nobody has to say, tell us don't eat meat. And nobody has to supervise that, even if we, some of us might have been eating meat earlier. Because the higher taste that Krishna consciousness has given us, as we have grown in Krishna consciousness, we have outgrown that desire. So we can see this happening with some gross desires. Some desires like, say, the desire for sex, desire for fame, the desire for power. Those may take a very long time to outgrow. But in general, as an example, educational field and biological age field. The point is, as we grow, our attractions and our understanding changes. So now, that is connected with the Vedic concept of adhikar. So when one has attained a particular level of maturity, then the person can get a particular kind of vision, can get a particular kind of understanding. So when we talk about Kanishta, Madhyama, Uttama, when we talk about spiritual advancement, in general, what are we talking about? It is not an necessarily abstract conception. We can talk about it in different terms, like the 9 stages of advancement of bhakti, through anartha nivritti up to prem eventually. Essentially, what is it that is changing? It is our conceptions, it is our attractions. So they are what change. So conception means our understanding of what it is. What is what? Our conceptions change. And then as our conceptions change, our attractions change. So, okay, this is what was fascinating for me earlier, but then I realized this is not very substantial. So, Kanishta, Madhyama and Uttama, that is a stages in the spiritual growth of a sadhaka. So, they are all connected with adhikar. One who has adhikar is called adhikari. So, Kanishta Adhikari, Kanishta means lowest in one's, or inferior. So, he has a very external vision of things. And because of that external vision of things, you know, he, as we know, sees God only in the temple. And he sees God as unconnected with the rest of the world. That means, how I behave in the world, how I behave with other devotees, what is my moral and spiritual fabric? That none of this matters. He feels, you just go to the temple and worship God and then I come back. That's good enough. So it's a materialistic vision. So actually speaking, the Bhagavatam and the Vedic scriptures say that one who worships deity is a Kanishta Adhikari. So one who doesn't even worship a deity, we can wonder what he is. So of course, the deity is primarily deity worship is primarily indicative of one thing. It is that people need material forms, not just in the same shape of a form of God, but material externals, external material objects to conceive of worship. That means I can't perceive God's presence everywhere. Therefore, I need a deity. Similarly, people associate with God, associate God with specific objects. So, now there is a school of thought, like I talked about Nidarshan, you know, how the abstract concept and the tangible, concrete symbol. So, the impersonalists have the idea that the deity worship is for less intelligent people. In fact, they say the whole process of bhakti is for less intelligent people. And when you go beyond, then you will understand that the worshipper and the worshipped are one and the same. So, they have widely propagated the idea that deity worship is for less intelligent people. And eventually, we have to go beyond deity worship. And to some extent, the statement is true. No, in the translation of that famous Yasyatma Buddhi Kunapeti Dhatuke, Swadhi Kulatradishu Bhaum Ijjadhi. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur translates Bhaum Ijjadhi as that intelligence which worships forms made of earth. That means earthen idols. And he says, those who worship this, they are called as Sa Eva Gokharaha. Gokharaha means they are like cows or asses. So this may be a little disturbing for us. Generally Prabhupada translates Bhaumijyadi as one who is attached to one's own country. And the word Bhumi is earth. So Bhauma can refer to the country or it can refer to any object made of earth. So Chakravarti Pada explains this very significantly. Chakravarti Pada himself had deities to worship. And all our Vaishnava Acharyas had deities to worship. So what he says is that in the neophyte stage, deity worship is something which is essential to bring discipline. And as one advances, it is not that one transcends deity worship. One worships deity spontaneously. Just like when a person becomes a Raganuga Bhakta, it's not that he gives up the rules and regulations. He follows them naturally. But in the initial stages of bhakti, deity worship is to some extent essential. Without that, one generally finds it very difficult to discipline one's bhakti. So, that now what he is saying in this verse is, if somebody, somebody's level of God consciousness stays stuck only at the level of Bhaumijyadi. That means one thinks God is present only in this earthen form and nowhere else. That is the level of consciousness that is condemnable, that is lamentable. So that gels very well with Kanishtha Adhikari. So Kanishtha Adhikari thinks that God is associated with certain external formularies and rituals. That's all. If you look at the whole verse, it is basically talking about material concepts. Syatma buddhi kunapaitir dhatuke. One who thinks that is spiritual to be material. That means he sees the atma is spiritual, but he thinks of it as material. Then what is the next thing? Sodhi kalatradishu bhauma ijjadhi. So he sees earthen forms as worshipable. And then yattirtha buddhi kalilena sarilena karichichu. So he thinks the purpose of going to tirtha is what? Just to take a bath, not to associate. So associate with saintly people and hear from them. Because hearing is what takes us to the spiritual level. In general, in the material world, Maya comes in through the eyes, Krishna comes in through the ears. It's a general rule. Of course, when we take darshan of deities, Krishna can come in through the eyes also. And if we hear Prajalva, Maya can also come in through the ears. But as a general principle, Maya primarily attacks through the eyes. And our attraction to Krishna develops through the ears. So somebody who thinks they're going to holy place, there's nothing to hear, they just have to go and take a bath. Then that is materialistic intelligence. So you know, we can have this four level diagram. See what is the consequence. So spiritual object, spiritual vision. That means we have the deity of Krishna. And the deity of Krishna is spiritual. And then the Mahabhagavat or the even the Madhyamadhikari, they have spiritual vision toward it. So spiritual object and spiritual vision. What does it lead to? It leads So, that's like say, Uddhava sees Krishna, and Uddhava would have in childhood also small duties of Krishna. He was so absorbed that when mother would call him for lunch, he would not go. He was experiencing ecstasy in those small duties of Krishna. So, for us, when we spiritually, we may not experience ecstasy, but still we can surely experience purification. So, now when we see spiritual objects materially, what results is offense. Offense is at worst, if we are offense in the sense that we have offensive, derisive mentality. At the least, what will happen is that there will be no purification. So, material object and material vision will lead to bondage. That means there are good-looking sense objects and you get attracted to them, thinking that they will give me pleasure. So, material object and material vision will lead to bondage. And what does material object and spiritual vision mean? That means utility is the principle. We see that everything can be engaged in Krishna's service.
So this also leads to purification.
So I'll repeat this table once again to be clear. See, objects have some ontological. Ontological means connected with their own existence. So they have certain innate features. And our vision has certain characteristics. So our vision can be material or spiritual, and the object can be material or spiritual. So when our object is, vision is material, that means we think of it in terms of what is in it there for me, what enjoyment can it give me. That's what we think of. When our vision is spiritual, we connect with Krishna and see whether it gives us remembrance of Krishna, whether it can be helpful for us in service to Krishna. So that is with respect to vision. Now here, when I'm talking about objects, at a very high level we can talk about the spiritual world where there are spiritual sense objects. Now all the senses, everything that they encounter is spiritual. Right now what we are talking about is spiritual objects that manifest in the material world. The deity may be made of matter, but deity is not only matter. So in that sense I'm talking about spiritual objects here. So spiritual objects could also be, so you know, material and spiritual is classified in two ways. One is by constitution and second is by application. So by constitution or by composition, both refer to the same thing. That means what is it made of? So from that point of view, we may say that the spiritual master's body is material. From that point of view, we may say that the deity is also material. That's composition point of view. And then from that point of view, see, the Atma is spiritual, because the Atma is not made up of Jada Tattva. The Atma is made up of what? Satchidananda, correct. Similarly, Krishna's original form is made of Satchidananda. So this is a classification by composition. What is it made up of? But along with that, there is also another classification, that is by application or utilization. So when we use something for sense gratification, it is material. When we use something for Krishna consciousness, that is spiritual. So this would mean that is everything ultimately in the vision only? Is it our vision that makes something material and something spiritual? Yes, it is. But beyond that, there is also a reality that there is something which is innately spiritual. There are things which are innately spiritual. So now, in that sense, if we see the deities with a spiritual vision, we get purified or we experience ecstasy. Similarly, if we see a Vaishnava, a senior Vaishnava whom we admire and respect, and we see him, we feel happy, we feel enlivened. So the Bhagavatam says that when a young devotee sees a senior Vaishnava, how does he feel? He feels like a peacock who sees the clouds in the sky. Peacock starts dancing, so like that the devotee feels so happy. So we may not feel like that all the time. But the point is, when there is a spiritual vision and a spiritual object, that leads to joy. Now when there is a spiritual object and material vision, then that can lead to offense. So somebody sees a deity and says, this is material, this is mundane. Somebody sees prasad and thinks that this is mundane. Of course, if he takes it, still he will be purified. But this is one thing which I forgot to mention, which indicates the extent of antipathy. Antipathy means negative feeling that is there towards deity worship in the Abrahamic religions. You know, in Israel, or more or less in the Western world, practically everybody, all women wear wigs. Women, as their hair start growing old and discolored, they start wearing wigs. So India is the world's biggest hair exporter. And the maximum hair export offer is from Tirupati Balaji. Where? So where the people cut off their hair and they sell it. So now, what happened was, many of the biggest wig manufacturers in the world, they get hair from Balaji and they make wigs out of it. So, and then many of these elderly Jewish ladies, they go to do service in their synagogues. Synagogue is just, Christians have a church, So the holy place of Jews is called synagogues. So at one time, maybe a few years ago, they came to know that the wigs made by a particular company is very popular. Those wigs had hair which had come from Tirupati Balaji. And then when the chief rabbi of the Jewish synagogue, he came to know about it, he said, we cannot afford to have our synagogue contaminated by the remnants of idolatry. We cannot have it contaminated by the remnants of idolatry. And he said, any woman who wears a wig from so and so company, she will not be allowed entry into the synagogue. And then at that time, thousands of wigs were brought together and they were all burnt in a bonfire. And then after that, the company had to give a written assurance. We will never again include ingredients from this particular place in India. Only then they said that we will purchase wigs from you. And the company now, at least for some time after that, on the wig packs itself, they had to write, no idolatry in this. So, you know, that is the level of antipathy that is there, which is quite unfortunate. So basically the point I was talking about is material. So if there is material vision towards spiritual objects, then one commits offenses. And beyond that is, we have, so Srila Prabhupada was in America. He was just walking on the first floor in San Francisco. And then below he saw a flatbed truck going by. A truck normally has side bars or parapets or whatever you want to call it. But he said it's a flatbed truck. And he saw that, and he thought, oh, we can put Jagannath Baldev Subhadra on this and we can have a Rath Yatra. So now how many people can think about Jagannath Baldev Subhadra Rath Yatra after seeing a flatbed truck? But that was Srila Prabhupada. You know, he saw a material object, but he saw it with spiritual vision, and he saw in it an opportunity to serve Krishna. So, in fact, in the Bhagavatam, when it talks about Bhagavad Bhavam Ikshita, it talks about this Uttam Adhikari, Madhyam Adhikari in the 11th canto. So there it says, Prabhupada translates that as, one who sees the potential in everything, matter and spirit, to be engaged in Krishna's service. So who is Uttam Adhikari? One who sees in everything, matter and spirit, the potential to be engaged in Krishna's service. So the hippies, from the puritanical Smartha Brahman point of view, they were extremely contaminated. But Srila Prabhupada saw in them the potential to be engaged in Krishna's service, the potential that they can become devotees. So that can lead to purification, that can lead to spiritual advancement, that can lead to benefit of the world. And then material vision, material object, it leads to karmic entanglement. People get attracted to sense objects. So now, where does the Kanishtha fall? Kanishtha, he has material objects and of course he has material vision. And for spiritual objects, he may have a spiritual vision. But apart from that, he cannot see in anything material the potential to be engaged in Krishna's service. He can see the deities are sacred, that's all. He cannot see, he needs strict religious formularies. Beyond that, he doesn't advance. So he has some level of God consciousness, but not much. So, beyond that is the Prabhupada talks about this. Now, why is the Prabhupada talking about this? Because this verse is talking about the level of consciousness which is similar to Uttam Adhikari. One who sees in everything spiritually. So, how will one get to that vision Prabhupada is talking about? So, then he talks about Madhyam Adhikari. And, you know, now this is of course a simplistic diagram because it is just depicting broad patterns. Now, so, Madhyam Adhikari does not see all material objects spiritually. He discriminates. So Haridas Thakur could see the prostitute also as a lost soul, and he could see her as a potential devotee. But not many sadhakas can do that, and should not try to do that also. Isn't it? So at that level, what do we do? Prema Maitri Krupopeksha. So to the innocent, we try to give Krishna's mercy. To the devotees, we befriend them. And to the envious, we keep a distance away. But beyond that, So, Srila Prabhupada talks of Madhyamadhikari, and Srila Prabhupada wanted that ISKCON devotees should at least be Madhyamadhikaris. So, Madhyamadhikaris means that we have to be able to differentiate. And, you know, this whole tendency that people have, that in spiritual circle you should not criticize anyone. That is an indication of Kanishta Adhikari. See, in spiritual level, one doesn't see differences because one has transcended. That is Uttam Adhikari level. In Kanishta level, one doesn't see differences because one has no knowledge only. One has no knowledge to differentiate. One has no knowledge to differentiate. So, that means, when a person is in the Madhyama stage, it is essential for him to discriminate. This is Anukul, this is Pratikul for my bhakti. And based on that only he will make spiritual advancement. Then one comes to the Uttama level. At that level, one is able to see everything spiritually. So then Srila Prabhupada talks about oneness that is false and real. We will come to that towards the end. But just one more way. The Nectar of Devotion talks about these three levels in a slightly different way from what Nectar of Instruction talks about. Not entirely different, but slightly different emphasis. So, you must have studied NOD. This is just a quick revision. So, NOD classifies this based on faith and knowledge. So, you know that. So, now why is it? So, it's interesting that the Madhyama has faith but not knowledge. And the Uttama has faith as well as knowledge. So how is it that normally you would think knowledge is theoretical, knowledge comes first, and faith is something which comes gradually. So faith is something which needs to be gradually developed by purification. So how is it that it is saying that faith comes first and knowledge comes later? See, this knowledge, this knowledge is realized knowledge. Not just realized knowledge, it is knowledge of how to apply spiritual principles. This knowledge has three components. First is the knowledge of how to convey one's faith to others. At a Madhyamadhikari level, one has basic knowledge. Without basic knowledge, one cannot have faith. That is there. But how to convey one's knowledge to others? This is not just a matter of material expertise. Material expertise is fine, but it's more in terms of actually conveying the subtle aspect of knowledge, conveying that faith. So, this knowledge is talking about how one should behave, one should act, by which one can inspire others to practice devotional service. That is the knowledge. So actually, realized knowledge we can call in one sense as faith itself directly. So it is something more. It is the knowledge of how to inspire faith in others. It is the knowledge of how to engage others in Krishna's service. So that knowledge is something which is quite advanced. So it requires a visionary acharya like Srila Prabhupada to be able to know how people in America can be engaged in Krishna's service. So several of his god brothers may have had more theoretical knowledge, but it was his deep conviction and that led to knowledge. So the ability to share the knowledge in a way that not just convinces people intellectually, but transforms them. Yeah. So this is about the Adhikara and Adhikari. Now going forward, then Srila Prabhupada talks about this false and real oneness. Sorry? Okay, three components of this. Yeah. First is the knowledge of how to convey one's faith to others. Second is knowledge of how to engage others in Krishna's service. It's one thing to help people and this is what is right. Okay, but then how do you act on that right knowledge? So that to some extent is like, that is like giving people abhideya. How do you engage in this? And then when people are going on the journey also, how to transform people's hearts. So this whole knowledge is not just realized in terms of one having seen it, but it is more in terms of applying it for others' transformation. So, this, of course, is a very advanced stage and we can all aspire for it. Now, if you see, Srila Prabhupada often defines things contextually. If you read and Madhurya Kadambini and Nectar of Devotion, you will understand that there are so many subtleties and so many advanced stages in bhakti. But if you read Nectar of Instruction, Prabhupada defines who is Uttamadhikari, one who chants 16 rounds very rigidly, follows the regulative principles, and is always thinking of expanding the Krishna consciousness movement. He's a Uttamadhikari. You think, you know, that's not so far away for me. But Srila Prabhupada, in principle, that is not false. Somebody who is doing these three things, he's always thinking of the welfare of others, always thinking of spreading Krishna consciousness, he is an Uttamadhikari. But actually, there is much more to it. So, you know, the GBC has formed a Prabhupada Hermeneutics Committee. Hermeneutics is the art or the science, whatever you want to call it, of interpreting or understanding scripture. So, Prabhupada Hermeneutics means, how do we understand Srila Prabhupada's words? So, one foundational principle, of course, the meetings are still going on, but one foundational principle that they have arrived at is that no one statement of Prabhupada should be taken as an exclusive statement of his position. Whenever we want to say Prabhupada says this, you should look at all the statements that Srila Prabhupada has made on that point and then understand it. Why? Because in certain contexts, Srila Prabhupada may make certain statements and they are true, but they may not be universally true. There's a disastrous thing that nearly happened in Vrindavan once. When Srila Prabhupada was saying, so some devotee, some temple manager, he went and told Prabhupada, you know, all these devotees are reading your books. Everybody is reading all esoteric previous acharya's books. So then Prabhupada said, all these books should be burnt. Another devotee was shocked. And then he sent the news. That, you know, all these books should be burnt. So then all books that everybody had, they brought it together. And then they were about to burn it. And finally one devotee went and he told Prabhupada, have you told the previous acharyas the book should be burnt? What? Prabhupada said, they are meant to be worshipped by us. How can they be burnt? And then he ran back and told him, just stop them from being burnt. So now somebody may say, Prabhupada, you only said that earlier and you are contradicting yourself. So Prabhupada said, don't you have any intelligence? The point is that in that particular situation, if devotees are prematurely jumping into advanced books, that is not desirable. But there are certain statements which are rhetorical. You know, rhetorical means they are said to convey an impact, to give an impact. But they are not meant to be taken literally. So can anyone give an example from scripture about statements that are rhetorical? Killer of the soul. Okay. That's metaphorical, not rhetorical. I'll give you one more example of rhetoric. Okay, you already got it? Yeah. If you hear blasphemy, you should cut the tongue. Not that. Or you commit suicide yourself. That is even more. So, you know, that is even worse. But the principle is that we should not hear it like that. Yeah. Tiger is also chasing you. Don't pray to the demigods. Is it? My God. Actually, yeah. Anyway, you have brought a good point. I wanted to talk about it. Okay, we'll talk about it later. Yeah, just one or two more examples. Associate non-devotees like embracing a tiger. Yes. Since there are so many examples like this. Yes. Commit suicide, yes. That is true. Yeah. One more, yes. Yes, I cast the demoniac people into hell. Now if you see, Srila Prabhupada is so subtle in that. Tanaham dvishataha kruran samsareshu naradhaman. Shipam yajisram shivam asurishu yajisram asurim yonam abhu. And it goes on. So now if you see, Srila Prabhupada translate that as what? Tanam dvishataha kruran. So I cast those, Prabhupada uses the word mischievous over there. If you look at Sanskrit point of view, dushyataha and kruran, where is mischievous? No, there is no mischievous anywhere. Isn't it? But Prabhupada is not just giving us a literal translation. He is giving us the heart of Krishna. So So what he is telling that for Krishna, this child is this only like a child. Why is he behaving in such a foolish way? So for Krishna, even the worst demon is just a mischief monger. So you know, why is he doing so mischief? Stop doing this. Sometimes, you know, father may tell a son, you know, if you do this, don't ever again enter in my house. And the point is not that he should stay out of his house. The point is he should not do this. Isn't it? So, certain statements are made where the rhetoric is for emphasizing a particular point. And that has to be understood from the overall culture in which it is given. If you look at the Bhagavad Gita, some people say that this verse from the Bhagavad Gita talks about eternal damnation. Krishna is going to cast the soul forever into hell. But if we see Krishna is saying elsewhere, apichetasi papebhya sarvebhya pakruttama sarvam pa jnanaplaveenaiva vrijanam santarishyasi. In 4.36 he says, no matter how sinful somebody is, that person will be elevated by taking shelter of, by cultivating knowledge. And similarly he says, mami partha vyapashita, even the lowest people will get elevated, he says 9.33. So like that, there are other verses which make things clearer. So rhetorical statement should not be taken out of context. Yeah. So, you had a question about demigod worship. We'll just come back to it a little later. Just keep it in mind. Okay, so we are talking about now about oneness, false and real. So, now, during Srila Prabhupada's time, see, Srila Prabhupada's purports are eternal in the sense that the principles there are eternal. But at the same time, in many cases, he is also responding to specific historical situations. He is responding, like we saw, he is talking about communism and capitalism. There actually it was explicit. But in many sensible places, it might not be explicit. But he is responding. So, during those times in India, you know, there was this artificial sense of oneness. Artificial sense of oneness means based on what? The idea, the Mayavadis have that everybody is equal. So if you say everybody is equal, at a material level, it is not true. At a material level, different people are at different levels. So Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya is not just a sectarian division just to promote somebody's selfish interests. It is just an objective classification based on observation of people's nature. So prematurely making everybody equal just doesn't work. And Indians tried it many times. So, you know, when, of course, this is political, but again the same point. When India became independent through apparently through non-violence, so after that it was felt that India is such a non-violent country. Why does India need to build an army? Why does India need to have a big armed force? So routinely, the armed force, the army was minimized. And building arms was sort of neglected. So actually how it worked was, when India became independent, as we were nearing independence, you know, there were two front runners for the post of Prime Ministership of India. One was Nehru and the other was Sardar Patel. So now Gandhi was like, at that time at least, he was like the kingmaker. So he was the most influential person. So now Nehru was also to a large extent non-violent. That's what Gandhi liked in him. But Nehru was totally anti-spiritual and highly westernized. That's what he didn't like in him. And Patel was quite, in one sense, traditional. He had a lot of faith and attraction for tradition India. But he's called the Iron Man of India. He was very determined about using violence if it was required. So then Gandhi decided to have Nehru as the Prime Minister. And then, actually, what happened, there are several letters from 1960 onwards, Sardar Patel is sending again and again, 1958, 59, 60, like that. You know, China is building up its force. We have to build up our defense. Otherwise, we will lose large parts. Actually, if you see Indian political history, it's a very sad history, the way it worked out. So, India was going to get the whole of Kashmir. What happened? But anyway, I'll not go into that. It will be too long. I'm just talking about the artificial sense of brotherhood. So let's focus on that. So what happened? So Nehru and the Chinese leaders, they had this whole idea of, we are all Hindi, Chini, Bhai, Bhai. And they were having that sort of slogans and they were building up weapons. And then one sudden day, China attacked. And you know, Indian soldiers were gallant. But the Indian soldiers had simple reloadable guns and Chinese had machine guns. Now you shoot one bullet, you have to bend the bullet down and get it up. By the time you are shot dead. They were just shooting with machine gun. Indians were completely out-technologied. You know, if it's a matter of technology, just valor doesn't help at that point. And no, China was just marching ahead. Just conquering down. And somehow, it was at that time that America came to the help of India. You know, President Kennedy, Nehru desperately called to Kennedy, and Kennedy sent weapons. And by the time weapons came, then China declared a unilateral ceasefire. But it was a loss of face, loss of land, and loss of life for India. And it was all because of this. If somebody is in a politician's post, is a Kshatriya, you know, he cannot have the idea of bhai-bhai towards enemies. Isn't it? The Kshatriya has to have real intelligence. So it is said that, you know, these Varanas also are classified in the way. A Brahmana, Chanakya says in Niti Shastra, that there should be no restriction for a Brahmana to go into any country. That's why Prabhupada would say, na, these visa officers are like dogs barking. So, for a... wow. So this is my country. Why are you coming here? Prabhupada would say like that. So Chanakya says, why? A Brahmana thinks of the welfare of the whole world. A Kshatriya thinks of the welfare of his country. He may think of the welfare of others also, but primarily his duty is for his country. A Vaishya thinks of the welfare of his family and relatives. Shudra, me only. It's like that. So, our modern society is actually characterized by what is called as individualism. Everybody is an eye specialist. No, eye specialist. So that's why, you know, if people are excessively individualistic, then even material relationships can't be maintained. If the mother thinks the child is a burden, then, you know, how can the generations go on? So actually that level of consciousness is very constricting. So the Kshatriya cannot have an artificial sense of oneness towards everyone. A Kshatriya has to discriminate. So this artificial sense of oneness, so Prabhupada is talking about here in a different context. He says in a sense of philanthropy, you think that a spiritually evolved person and a spiritually very, you know, if everybody is equal, then that's why they had the idea of Manav Seva hi Madhav Seva. So that is not correct. So actually, that's what Srila Prabhupada is responding to in this purport if you read it. See, this artificial sense of oneness is entirely false. You know, so how it is that one has to first learn discrimination. This is anukul to bhakti, this is pratikul to bhakti. This is anukul to Krishna, this is pratikul to Krishna. And then when one's consciousness is completely Krishnaized, then one can see everybody potentially spiritual. And everybody can be engaged in Krishna's service. Everybody can be an object of Krishna, of a pure devotee's mercy. So that means, there is material diversity we see. So this is, okay, I've illustrated over here. So accept bodily diversity and realize spiritual unity. Accept bodily diversity means that everybody is physically different. We can't deny that. But all of us are spiritually similar. So how is that? Here's a diagram to illustrate this. So yesterday I discussed about the various social systems, how history evolved. So now if you see communism, the idea is very good. Everyone is equal. But what happens is, it imposes artificial material equality. That means, imagine if there is an exam, if there is a classroom, and the teacher at the start of the semester tells, so we want equality in the class. So, all of you will get equal marks at the end. So what will happen by that? You know, the intelligent people will feel no motive to study, and the lazy people will feel no motive to study. Isn't it? The unintelligent people will feel also, I'm going to get the reward, what does it matter? So, imposing artificial material equality, what does it do? It, talented people are not rewarded, people become lethargic, and what happens is, most people live in scarcity. And so stay dissatisfied. So Prabhupada, when he went to Russia, he saw, and you know, for grains and for small things, there were so many long queues. Now what capitalism says that, it tries to impose material equality, that's communism. And capitalism, it just says, we don't have equality, so let there be diversity. You know, it just every man is up to his own means. As much as you can earn, as whatever power you can grab, you get accordingly. So it allows wealth and wealth to determine position and power. So what happens is, wealthy exploit the needy. The world gets fractured, divided into haves and have-nots. But what does the caste system do? The Varnashram, not exactly the caste system. What does it do? Actually, the word caste system is not wrong. It has just got negatively tainted now. It's become negatively tainted. So, it recognizes the spiritual equality of everyone. But at the same time, not able to see it, or you're able to see it there. Okay, yeah, all of you have the PPT, it's fine. So, it also recognizes that there is material diversity. So, yes, everybody is spiritually equal, but materially different people are at different levels. Let them be engaged in ways that by which they can gradually get purified and make advancement. So, this is the underlying principle of Varnashram. Spiritually, everyone is equal, materially, everyone is different. So, when did Varnashram become exploitative? When the spiritual equality of everyone was forgotten. When people became materialistic in vision, started thinking, you are low caste, that means you are low limb, and you have to stay low. So that's when the caste system became exploitative. But this is the principle. So Udhiya Luktam Adhikari, he understands that everybody is spiritually equal, but at the same time he understands that different people are at different levels right now. And they need to be engaged accordingly. Then only there will be proper spiritual growth. Yes, any questions? Yes, Mr. Chalampu. Okay, how does communism work? When it was practiced in USSR, it was the idea that the government will give jobs to everyone and everybody will have the same kind of houses, everybody will have the same kind of dress, everybody will have the same kind of ration, what food you will get. So basically, you contribute to the economy and the government will give everybody almost equal returns. That's how they try to bring equality. So what happens is, still the power is vested with the government. And those who are in the position of allocating resources to others, their position becomes very influential. Yeah. That's how it was theoretically planned. Which is quite strange. Now actually, what happened behind the Iron Curtain is still a history. Mystery, not history. It's a history that's a mystery. And now people don't know. But overall, people were very dissatisfied. Although it is said that things are working wonderfully. That was what Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels' idea was. It did not relate. Of course, the experiment went on for almost 70 years. 1917 to almost 1990. Maybe say, yeah. So it was not very successful because they became very powerful at an international level. But overall, after it collapsed, the Russian economy was in a state of disaster. And not only was the economy in a state of disaster, then the whole USSR split into different countries. Now we have the CIS, they call it the loose confederation, this Commonwealth of Independent States.
So now what flavor of communism China and Russia?
Well, Russia is not communist. Russia is having democracy and they have elected leaders. China is a very curious case. It is communist as a political system and it is capitalist as an economic system. That means it has adopted, as of now, you know, it doesn't have really what you can call as a democracy or free rights or anything like that for everyone. Although there is now gradually this social networks have had a tremendous impact in making sure that information cannot be hidden. You know, so the government tries to portray one picture or something, and then the social media just floods up with the other picture. So China's control over its own people has become greatly undermined. So now China is trying very vigorously to just block the internet in many places. So, but the point is that they have quite a dictatorial type of government. Largely, although they have some internal elections within the ruling party and things like that, something is there, but overall it's dictatorial. But they have adopted all sort, almost like Western economic values to become economically powerful. Okay? Yeah. Where is the mic? Hare Krishna. Okay.
Uttam Adhikari. So if one is so much on exalted platform, devotion, but just because he's not from good educational background, he may not have that competency to convince others. So whether he's then Uttam Adhikari or Madhyam Adhikari.
Okay, good question. When you talk about knowledge, when you talk about competency in convincing others, it's not just in terms of philosophical arguments. It's also in terms of sharing one's faith. See, bhakti is ultimately about instilling faith in others. And not only faith, it's also inspiration. So some devotee who is sincerely serving Krishna, that person may not speak much, but just by seeing his example, others get inspired. So Jayadvait Maharaj once asked, you know, what gives you faith in Krishna consciousness? Sometimes people ask a little bold question. So he gave a very fascinating answer. He says, you know, when I go to Vrindavan temple, there is one old brahmachari. For the last 35 years, every morning in Guru Puja, I see him serving Charanamrita. And seeing him gives me faith in Krishna consciousness. So the fact that somebody is doing such a simple service, just serving Charanamrita. And in fact, you know, I regularly visit Jayadeva Maharaj's site. So when that brahmachari passed away around 3 years ago, Jayadeva Maharaj personally wrote a memorial of him. You know, describing about his life and everything. And nobody knew him. You know, he had not really preached and made people into devotees. He was not a manager, he was not a guru. But still, just doing that simple service of giving Charanamrita and being able to continue to do that indicate that the person is getting spiritual taste. So, that means if somebody can give faith to others and give inspiration to others, the person may not be a big preacher. So that knowledge is more in terms of lived knowledge. And it's through one's living that one is sharing it. Okay? Yeah.
We hear sometimes, so you said that Uttam Adhikari is the one who can instill faith in others. However, Uttam Adhikari is also the one who does not feel the need of preaching also. So the means because he sees everybody is a pure devotee except me. So then we also find some Uttam Adhikaris may actually do the role of Madhyam Adhikari devotees, but others will be who will not choose to. So then how will we understand this?
Correct. This is a very important question. In the sense that, so Uttam Adhikaris, if they don't see any difference, then how can they actually give faith or give inspiration to others? See, many times in the Vedic literature, terms are multivalent. Multivalent means the same word has many meanings. Like yesterday, karmanya, karmaya, pashyet. So our word karma has many different meanings. So the word Uttam Adhikari in different contexts means different things. Which are related at one same level, at one similar level of exalted spiritual advancement. But it's not exactly identical. So when one book is used, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Krishna Samhita, when he uses the word Uttam Adhikari, he uses in a very different sense over there. So the word may be the same, but the word has different senses in different contexts. That is something we have to understand. So Uttam Adhikari is not just a level, it's a continuum. It's a continuum. In which, continuum means, you know, it's like a spectrum which continues over a large direction, large distance. So in that, towards the upper end of that continuum, is the exalted devotee who just doesn't see any difference. But in that also, in the Uttam Adhikari stage also, there are the very advanced devotees who see the need for preaching. They see the need for preaching because they see it is Krishna's desire, it is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's desire that is. So at our level, we may preach because it is the instruction of our spiritual master. Or it's maybe just because we like to preach. Whatever. So, but for them, it is directly coming as an imperative from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's desire. That's why it's different. So Kanishtha Adhikari is not just one discrete level, but it's more of a broad spectrum with the common denominator of a very exalted spiritual consciousness. Is it clear? Yeah. So, yes, Vishwam Bhagavad, we had a question. Sorry. Yeah.
So to which extent that we go in this not demigod worship but having Ganapati at the door or installing the deities of demigods as such?
Correct. To what extent do we go in demigod worship? I'll answer this. We'll talk in broad principles about demigod worship in Sambhuti or Sambhuti verse. But I'll just talk about the, because he also referred to Ramanacharya. You know, in the Sri Sampradaya, they are very strict. So like, I know one current Sri Acharya, Sri Vaishnava Acharya, is Chaturvedi Swami, very intelligent person. So he will go to a Muslim mosque and a Christian church, but he will not enter a Shiva temple. It's impossible. In fact, in Chaitanya Charitamrita also, we have the description that when Ramanacharya was sort of slapped by Jagannath, then he sort of flew from there and he came to Kurmakshetra. And Prabhupada writes in the purport that when he woke up, he thought that actually this is a Shiva Linga. And he thought, oh, I have come into Shiva temple. How can I? What aparadha I have committed to my Lord? So he started fasting in repentance as an atonement for having entered a Shiva temple. And then, what happened after that? Then he got the realization, this is actually not Lord Shiva, this is Lord Kurma. Then he started offering prayers and started worshipping. So they have the logic that, which is a little strange logic. What is that? That just as a married woman will never go into the house of another man. So like that, a devotee worshipper of Vishnu should not enter the temple of any other devta. So now, aren't all the other devtas are not other devtas, they are servants of Vishnu. That is true. So the acharyas are responding to historical situations. What is the responding to historical situations? Like one person asked me a question recently on the website. So he said, you know, you see, historically, it seems that the acharyas become more and more intolerant to demigod worship. That means if you look in Mahabharata, it's very nonchalantly described that when Drupada wanted to get a son who would kill Dronacharya, he worshipped Shiva. And from that he got Drishtadyumna and he got Draupadi also. Or it is very nonchalantly described that when Yudhishthira wanted to get food, Dhaumya, who was a Vaishnava, Yudhishthira was a Vaishnava, Dhaumya told Yudhishthira to worship Surya so that he would get Akshayapatra. So if you see in the scriptures, there is a lot of demigod worship. In fact, very curious incident, just after Krishna finished speaking the Bhagavad Gita, and Arjuna is ready to fight. At that time, Krishna tells Arjuna, stop. He says, you should actually chant the prayers to Devi. And by she is very powerful. She is the goddess of destruction, he calls her at that time. And by her grace, if you please her, then you will be able to destroy your enemies. And then Lord Arjuna immediately gets down and starts offering prayers to Devi. And then Devi comes in the sky, appears, she offers blessings. And she tells, you know, as long as Vasudeva is with you, victory is guaranteed for you. Because he is my Lord also. Something like that, she says. So then you may wonder, you know, why does Krishna have to tell him to worship Devi? But even in the Ramayana, we have Lord Ram worshipping the Devatas in many places. In fact, it's even more curious. What happens is, when Indra finally comes and thanks Lord Ram for killing Ravana. So, Lord Ram, it's a very interesting situation that in the Ramayana, Lord Ram does not normally acknowledges divinity, at least in Valmiki Ramayana. Valmiki Ramayana starts with the question, who is the ideal person? Who has all good qualities? Who has all dharma, all valor, all truthfulness? So the focus of Valmiki in describing Lord Ram's character is to depict him as an ideal human being. If he depicts him as God, then people say, oh, he's God, he can do all that, we can't do it. So his focus is always to depict him as an ideal human being. And that's why, although periodically it will be revealed that Lord Ram is God, but Lord Ram acts as a normal human being. That's why as when Ravana is killed and Indra comes, and then Indra thanks him, and then Indra says at that time, you know, the darshan of God never goes in vain. So please ask for some benedictions. So then what does Lord Ram ask for? He says, Dutavanara Jeevanaha. He says, let all the monkeys who have been killed, even those whose bodies have been decapitated and their hands and legs have been cut, let all of them come back to life. And let all of them, wherever they live, never suffer from any shortage of food or water or any other shortage like that. So Indra says, it's a very difficult benediction to get all of them revived again. But you have done a very difficult task for us. So I'll give you the benediction. And all the monkeys just get up as if they have just had a very nice and sound sleep. And so then that means Lord Ram asks benedictions from the Devata. So Lord Ram is acting as a ideal human being. So how it is that in the Vedic times, when the Mahabharata is written, at that time, demigod worship was an integral part of Vedic culture. But there was no confusion about who is supreme. So it is understood that Krishna Vishnu is supreme and other gods are assisting him. So with this knowledge, if other gods are worshipped, it's not a problem. The gopis also worship Katyayani, and we glorify in prayers about Radharani that she is worshipping Surya. So demigod worship in and of itself is not wrong or bad. But over a period of time, as the Vedic times started descending, you know, certain demigod worshippers started claiming that our God is supreme. And then that started leading to confusion about who is supreme. And when there was confusion about who is supreme, then the acharyas, to emphasize that only Vishnu is supreme, said that other gods should not be worshipped. That's why Ramacharya says that other gods, because at that time, if you study Ramacharya history, you know that how there was this Kolatanga, the Shaivite king, he persecuted Vaishnavas at that time. So now, the acrimony between the bad feelings between Shaivites and Vaishnavites were quite bad at that time. And therefore the Acharya said, don't worship Lord Shiva. But we see the same, we say Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he goes, he is written Shiva Ashtakam, glorifying Lord Shiva as a devotee of Lord Krishna. Now, as we come down, Srila Prabhupada, now he translates Bhakti Samasindhu as it is, that, you know, yes, a devotee should worship Ganesh to start off their activities. What did Prabhupada say? You know that famous letter. What did Prabhupada say in that letter? Yes, you can worship Ganesh if you give me $1 lakh every month. So, this is basically a way of saying don't worship Ganesh. So, why? Because again, when there is a situation where there is confusion about who is supreme, we don't want to add to the confusion. So, the Vedic scriptures are conclusively monotheistic, but they are not exclusively monotheistic. Exclusively monotheistic is only one God is supreme. And all other gods are false gods. They are competitor gods, and to worship them is to be unfaithful to the supreme God. That is not the Vedic understanding. All the other gods are assistant gods, and for specific things they can also be worshipped. It's not wrong or sinful to worship. They are not being unfaithful to Krishna to worship them. But there are times when they can be worshipped, there are times when they should not be worshipped. For pure devotee, the other gods should not be worshipped. That is how it is. So, we will reserve questions about demigod worship to a little later time, because we will come back again to this point. Let's move forward now to the next verse. This is mantra 6. Mantra 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah. 7, no? Okay, can I have one book? I'll quickly go over this. Yeah. Yasmin sarvani bhutani atme va bhud vijanataha tatraka moha kah shoka ekatvam anupashyatah. Okay. So this is sort of a further split up of the last three paragraphs, 5th, 6th, 7th paragraphs, in the same verse itself. What is actually anupashyati? Okay. Let's move forward now. So here, so here Srila Prabhupada talks about, can somebody read the translation?
One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be written or understood for him?
Yeah. Tatra ko maha moha kaha shoka. These verses are similar to 6.13 in the Bhagavata. Yomam pashyati sarvada sarvam chami pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachame na pranashyati. Person will never be lost. So that is the overview, no? So Prabhupada basically in the whole purport is largely elaborating on the one word that is the feast for the Mayavadis. Which is it? Ekatvam. Ekatvam. So first Prabhupada explains Ekatvam as oneness between energy and energetic. Prabhupada is the example of fire. Then here, interestingly enough, Srila Prabhupada uses the example of the drop. But we had discussed earlier, he uses the example of drop for what? Talk about qualitative oneness. I'll come back to that later. Then he talks about, first he talks about oneness in quality, then he talks about oneness in interest. And he used two examples, how members of family are one interest, members of a nation are one interest. And then he talks about how pruthak drishti, separate interests cause shoka and moha. The beautiful sentence over there. The first paragraph, the first paragraph that starts on page 52. I don't know, in your book, which is the page number. This is the fourth page of the purport. A godless civilization arises from illusion and the result of such a civilization is lamentation. So what begins in moha ends in shoka. So what is it? The idea of there being no God is itself moha. And it ends in shoka. And then Srila Prabhupada concludes with how we need to become one in interest with God. So how do we become one in interest with God? That is ultimately by the practice of bhakti. It is not by the dissolving of our identity. So, this is an important point. Yeah. On the spiritual advanced path, we need detachment. But especially in the devotional path, we need humility. So, recognizing our oneness in quality with God brings detachment. If God is spiritual and I am spiritual, and what am I doing trying to enjoy material things? But it is only when we recognize our subordination and quantity to God that it brings humility. Generally, the path of jnana is often associated with pride. Because all these people are in illusion. I have gone beyond illusion. So, only when we understand that we are tiny. We are not God. We are gods. We are tiny. That brings humility. So, if we see, in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Shikshashtakam, he talks about humility before renunciation. He talks about Sunadarapi Sunichena first, and then he talks about Nadharam Najaram Nasundari. So on the devotional path, humility is considered a greater virtue, or a more foundational and essential virtue, than renunciation or detachment. Because it is humility that enables us to connect with Krishna.
attached, feels attached. Somebody is attached to matter, detached from Krishna.
Where is the mic? Hare Krishna. So, there are these four categories of people. Do all of you know this already? Or should I? Okay, I'll just quickly repeat it. So, for those of you on. So, if somebody is attached to matter and detached from Krishna, that is a materialistic person. Yes, though it doesn't care for Krishna. Now, somebody who is detached from matter and detached also from Krishna, that is a Mayavadi. You know? So, they have no attachment to Krishna, they just want to merge into things. Now somebody who is attached to Krishna and attached to matter, or you can put it more explicitly, Maya, that is Sahajiya. And then there is a devotee is what? He's detached from Maya and attached to Krishna. So, the Mayavati has detachment from matter. But, no, he is detached even from Krishna. He doesn't care for Krishna much. He thinks Krishna is also a product of Maya from which I have to become detached. So, in this table, if we see, the important point is to have both in balance. To have attachment to Krishna and to have detachment from matter. Then we can make balanced spiritual advancement. So shall I move forward? Shri Prabhupada, so now I am talking about some examples from the Sandarbha of Yuga Goswami. So about how he talks about the Achintya Bheda Veda relationship. So he used the same example, but he talks about it in a slightly different way. So the first example he talks about for taking out Achintya Bheda Veda is fire and light. So he says, you can put fire and heat and light. So heat and light are the energies of fire. So Prabhupada used the same example. But then, this first example of fire and heat and light conveys that the energy and energetic are non-different. In one sense that all of them together are one. But we really can't talk much about different kinds of energy using this example. Isn't it? Heat and light are in one sense integral. So, to fire. So that's why he uses the next example of sun. And now normally we use it for Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagwan. He uses it for something slightly different. He says the sun is a unit. You know, it stayed in one place, but it's spreading its energies everywhere. So, on the sun, there is a predominating sun god. That is Krishna. Now, around the sun, there is a fiery orb which is extremely hot. And then beyond that, radiating away from the sun is the sunlight. So, the fiery orb that is there around the sun, that is constantly interacting with the sun. Where the sunlight that is going away, that is not interacting, that is just going away. Ultimately coming from the sun, but it is going away. So he says that the fiery orb around the sun is like the antaranga shakti. Or it is the internal energy. And the energy that is going away from the sun is the bahiranga shakti. The rays that are going away from it is the tatastha shakti. They are originating from it, but they are going away. But now far away from the sun, when we see a reflection, the reflection is there because the sun is there. But the changes in the reflection don't affect the sun directly. That is like the material energy. That is the material world. So he gives this three example of the sun's three aspects to talk about how there is variety within energy of the Lord. So I mentioned this earlier. So when he says, when you say fire burns, so fire is a noun and verb burn is a verb. So fire, there is normally no burning without fire, and we can't conceive of fire without it having its burning property. But still, fire doesn't always burn. And if I put my hand in it, it burns. So fire and burns, they are two distinct sentences, the words. And both of them together, they convey a meaning. So fire is same as well as different from the power of burning. So fire has the power of burning. So just like Bhagawan has a Shakti. And then Srila Prabhupada goes here into the whole concept of rasa dance. So imagine Ishopanishad, you know, all these persons are there, suddenly Prabhupada brings in the rasa dance over there. It's a quite a graphic thing. Of course, in this purport I mentioned earlier, Prabhupada also talks of the family of the Supreme Brahman. Can you just show me? I just read out. It's a very beautifully worded sentence. Okay. Is it being changed? Which one? Okay. Can you read it out? The same situation is randomly arranged in the absolute family of the Parabrahman or the Supreme Spirit. So, family of Parabrahman. And then Prabhupada immediately, somebody may surprise, oh, how can the family of Parabrahman? Prabhupada clarifies. The Parabrahman is as much as a person as the individual living entities. Just as we can have our family, the Pai and the Parabrahman have family. And then Prabhupada talks about unity. We are all individuals, but still unity will be there when there is love. And the Rasa dance, if you see the Rasa, it's very interesting that Shukadeva Goswami refers to all the gopis or as Shri Gopya Uchu. It doesn't say Shri Gopi Uvacha. It doesn't say Shri Radhika Uvacha, Shri Lalita Uvacha, Shri Vishakha Uvacha. It just says Shri Gopya Uchu. So Uchu is the plural of Uvacha. So why does he say that? Because although every gopi is an individual and she has her individual relationship with Krishna, at that particular time, all of them are burning in the fire of separation from Krishna. And all of them are experiencing a similar agony in separation from Krishna. So now, our Goswami Acharyas, they have explained that there is 19 verses of the Gopi Geet. So actually, each verse is spoken by one Gopi. And by analyzing the contents of the verse, the Acharyas analyze this verse is spoken by this Gopi. And this verse is spoken by this Gopi. You know, in terms of what relationship each Gopi has with Krishna. But when each Gopi is speaking a particular verse, she is expressing both her individual feeling according to her individual relationship with Krishna and the collective feeling of separation from Krishna. So, the Rasleela actually illustrates this individuality amidst unity. Every gopi is individual and she has her own heart which is burning in separation from Krishna. But she is also a representative of a group and all of them are burning in separation from Krishna. So, that's why Srila Prabhupada talks about this rasa dance over here. And then finally Prabhupada talks about how we cannot have a utopia in this world. We need to have, you know, realistic purification before we can have unity. So there has to be purification, then we can advance, then there will be unity. So are there any questions? Yes, Prabhupada. Okay, we'll just come to that. I have to discuss that. Any other questions? Yeah. Key terms on which impersonalists and Mayavadis are differentiated. Firstly, all Mayavadis are impersonalists, but not all impersonalists are Mayavadis. That means Mayavad is a subcategory within impersonalism. Now, if you see to a large extent, Srila Prabhupada in his usage equates impersonalists with Mayavadis many places, but not always. Hare Krishna. So Mayavadis and Brahmavadis. So in the Bhagavad Gita, 12.3 to 5 is referring to Brahmavadis. 9.11-12 and 7.24 is referring to Mayavadis. So what is the fundamental difference? The fundamental difference is there is no offense to the form of God. Whereas Mayavadis offend the form of God. Offend the form means what? They say that beyond the form is the formless. Like I think yesterday I told you about why does Krishna have a black color? You have to go beyond the black to the white. So like that they offend the form of God. And I think we have to go beyond the form to the formless light. Whereas, the Brahmavadis, they just don't know about the form or they do not attract to the form. They say, we want to go and merge in the light. That's all. That is the foundational difference between the two. Okay? Any other questions? So, yes, bro. Give the mic to him.
Bro, you are telling that the external energy is a reflection of the sunlight. So, where is it getting reflected? Like, on which object or?
Okay, good question. The external energy is a reflection of sunlight. So, where is it getting reflected? Now, Jiva Goswami use this metaphor or analogy in the Sandarbhas for one specific purpose. The specific purpose is to indicate something. So what is that indication? That there can that the same object, at one level the energy and energetic are non-different. But at another level the energies themselves are different. And different energies have different relationships with the energetic. Different relationships have different relationship with the energetic. But the purpose of this analogy is not to depict what the absolute truth is, but to talk about the variety within the energies of the absolute truth. So therefore, you know, if we were like Mayavadis who are saying Brahman is the only reality, then what happens? There's nothing apart from Brahman. So there's nothing to reflect Brahman in anything else. But what Jiva Goswami is saying over is something different. He is not giving this analogy to talk about what is the nature of the absolute truth. See, we understand that the material energy is what does the if the sun is reflected on the earth, what is the relationship of the reflection on the sun? They may look similar, but the reflection doesn't have any effect on the sun. So Srila Prabhupada conveys this to us. This is actually, there are very few places in which Srila Prabhupada gives his own brilliant insights in the Bhagavad Gita, which are not given by the previous acharyas. And one such place is in the translation and purport of 7.4. What is 7.4? Bhumira apo nalo vayu, kamano buddhirevacha, ahankara iti yamme bhinna prakriti rashtadha. So now, all the previous acharyas, starting from Shankaracharya down to Baldev Vidyabhushan, they all say that this refers to that Prakriti, my energy is divided into 8 divisions. Into 8 separate divisions. These are earth, water, fire, air, ether. So, they apply this word Bhinna to, there are 8 separate divisions. But Prabhupada applies it to Prakriti and he says, my separated energy comprises of earth, water, fire, air, ether. So the concept of separated energy, Prabhupada illustrates in a very disarming way. One time some young girl asked Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada, if God is beautiful, then why is this, God is good, why is this world so bad? So what did Prabhupada say? He says, if you are beautiful, why is your stool ugly? Prabhupada, she was shocked. That was the least thing she expected. So that Prabhupada's finally, that is your separated energy. So, Prabhupada emphasizes this point of separated energy. Of course, Prabhupada gives another example of separated energy. He says that, you know, if my voice is recorded in a tape recorder and you play the tape recorder. So, I am there in the tape recorder and yet I am not there in the tape recorder. So, the tape recorded voice is my separated energy, Prabhupada says. So, this example is given primarily to convey the point of a separated energy. The reflection would not be there if the sun was not there. But at the same time, the reflection in and of itself doesn't affect the sun. So, what is the separation? See, Krishna's internal energy affects him. If Radharani gets upset, he gets upset. Krishna's internal energy directly affects him. Because he's directly performing pastimes over there. But Krishna's separated energy doesn't directly affect him. In this material world, if somebody blasphemes Krishna, Krishna is not bothered about it. Now, this is one of the reasons why when Yudhishthira Maharaj asked Narad Muni in the 7th canto that, you know, this Shishupal blasphemed Lord Krishna so terribly. You know, his tongue should have fallen off, he should have got leprosy and nothing happened. On top of it, I saw that he entered into the body of Krishna, he attained liberation. How is that? So one of the things Narad Muni replies, and Chakravarti Pad elaborates, is that actually Krishna is not affected by the blasphemy of anybody in the material world. He says that even those people who have understood their Atma, they are not affected by the blasphemy. Then for that person who is only the Atma only, whose whole body is spiritual, why will he be affected? So, you know, if Krishna is performing Rasalila with the gopis, and somebody here blasphemes him, Krishna will not say, oh, today I lost my mood because this person has blasphemed me. I will not perform Rasa later. So Krishna is blissful over there. So in that sense, the material energy is separated from Krishna. So here, the purpose of the analogy is not to talk about the where something is reflected. Because we are not talking about the nature of the absolute truth over here. We are talking about the mutual relationship of the energies and the relationship of energies with the law. So the purpose of the analogy is to say that how the changes in the material energy do not affect the Supreme Lord. Now sometimes when the changes become very disruptive, the Lord comes to the material world. Yada yada dharmasya. But that is by His swechha. Is it clear? Yeah. Okay. Even that. That's it. Yeah, yeah. This one will complete.
So the energies can undergo changes without the intervention of the Lord.
Maya adhyakshena prakriti. The supervision of the Lord is there, but there need not be any active engagement of the Lord. His supervision is there. Yes, Prabhu.
Affected by material, that thing. Like, we hear the pastime of Varahadev when Hrinaksha was killed. So, when he was blaspheming the Lord, actually, Lord. In the heart,
so, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, heart. This is just the leela of the Lord to increase the fighting spirit over there. Sometimes Krishna may also seem to be affected. You know, actually, what is that? Nectar of devotion, dhira dhata, dhira prashant, dhira lalit, all those qualities are there. So Krishna, because he descends in the Kshatriya family, and he acts like a Kshatriya, or sometimes he may incite others by insulting them, and sometimes he may appear incited by insulting them. But that is just the leela, to increase the flavor of the pastime. Krishna is not directly affected. Just like Krishna, sometimes when Bhishma is shooting arrows, he manifests blood. But actually Krishna's body is spiritual, there cannot be any blood over there. But Krishna manifests that so that the rasa of the pastime is enhanced. Okay? Yes.
Where does other religions fit in Mayavadi or
Brahmavadi? Where do other religions fit in Mayavadis or Brahmavadis? Well, Srila Prabhupada generally talked about them as preliminary levels of bhakti. Preliminary levels of bhakti. Although, as I said that, they are, see Islam, although they are against the form of God, they accept God as a person. So they are not in that sense Mayavadis. Although they are quite strongly against the form of the Lord. But still the idea is that they accept a person. So Prabhupada said that they also offer namaz, and they also offer mass. So there's a preliminary level of bhakti this. Some of them may be very advanced, but overall it's a preliminary level of bhakti. Can't they come under Brahmavadis? Not necessarily, because they do have certain concepts. See, it's like There are multiple things. At a functional level, they are mostly at Karmakand, and Brahmavad is very advanced. So in Karmakand and in Bhakti, where the similarity is that there is a beseeching of a higher authority. Whereas in beseeching means begging or requesting of a higher authority. Whereas in Brahmavad, there is a more of emphasis on intellectual analysis and renunciation. So, if you see at least Islam, there is not much emphasis on renunciation per se. In fact, there are some Muslims who say that celibacy is a sin against God. They go even to that level. Not all, some say that. So, that certainly renunciation is not a characteristic of Islam. At least mainstream Islam. Modern Islam, to a large extent, is a struggle for political power in the name of religion. It's largely that. There may be some spiritual people, but it has largely become a struggle for political power. Yeah, objection. Do Christians accept God as a person? They accept God as three persons. Now, they are the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So, Christianity, apart from the, I talked about the division in Catholics and Protestants. This is more in terms of organization. But in terms of theology, there was a big division in Christians in Unitarians and Trinitarians. Unitarians means God is only one person. Trinity says God is three entities. There is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And all three are together. So the Father, the Son, they call it the Holy Ghost also. So, one time Srila Prabhupada was asked about the Holy Ghost. Prabhupada replied, all ghosts are unholy. So, but the idea is that they, to some extent, accept God as a person, but there are two categories of thought in Christianity. Anyway, I don't want to go into too much analysis now, Christianity again. But the point is, they first and foremost say that God is beyond verbal description. So therefore, any attempts to describe God in terms of words is flawed. And this is how they try to justify the absence of knowledge of God in their scriptures. They say God is beyond verbal description only. But they do accept God as a person to some extent. Because Jesus did talk of Christ in terms of his Father. Thou Father, thou art in heaven. And this Islam considers to be blasphemy. If Muslims say that, to say that we are the children of God is blasphemy of God. To say that we are the children of God is blasphemy of God. Why? Because children are born through sex, and sex is an animalistic activity. So you are bringing God to the animal level by saying that we are the children of God. So they say we are servants of God, we are not children of God. And they consider one of the greatest blasphemies that Christianity is saying, doing is by calling Jesus the Son of God. That is a great blasphemy according to them. So anyway, coming to our point So our Praveen Prabhu had one more question, which I felt is just, I won't go into the details of the answer. So he was asking, yesterday I talked about his philosophy, the different sampradayas. So what is our connection with Madhva sampradaya? Are we Madhvites or are we different? Or how is it? So if you look at the Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in chapter 7, chapter 8 of the Madhya Leela, describe the travels of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to South India. So there when he meets the Tattvavadis were the followers of Madhva. So while talking with them, he says, Tomara Sampradaya, not Amara Sampradaya. He says, in your Sampradaya, there's a lot of emphasis on Karmakanda. So he clearly differentiates between Madhvacharya Tattvavadi Sampradaya and he says, there is your sampradaya, and in that there is too much emphasis on Mayavad, on Karmakand, not Mayavad, sorry. They are hardline against Mayavad. So very strongly. In fact, in Madhva Sampradaya, the qualification for sannyas is that you have to go 3 times around Udupi declaring, I declare that Vishnu is the supreme person. If anybody wants to oppose, let him come and debate with me. And when he debates, then if the Mayavadi comes and debates, he has to defeat him in debate, only then he is given sannyas. So there's a purpose of sannyas is to establish the paratva of Vishnu. So they had a very big fighting spirit. So what they would do is, they would write books refuting Advaitavad. They would write books like Advaita Kalanala. Kalanala is the fire of destruction. And then they would get 2 big elephants and place those books on the elephant. And send one elephant to Varanasi, send another elephant to Kanchi. And you know, drop the bombs in the right in the middle of the Mayavadis. Here is a book refuting their philosophy. Then all the Mayavadis will come together. How to refute this now? How to try to refute this? So they had a very vigorous fighting spirit. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appreciated that. He said that you establish Vishnu as a person, so you have appreciated that. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in his books, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has taken two points from all the sampradayas and has integrated them. So, as far as we are concerned, do we belong to Madhva Sampradaya? Well, officially yes, doctrinally no. That means, officially means what? In general, in the Indian tradition, nobody can become a spiritual teacher without being initiated by some spiritual master. He is coming in Sampradaya. So if you see, Ramanujacharya, who was his guru? Yadav Prakash was who? Hamayavadi. So then Ramanujacharya took initiation in Mayavad Sampradaya, but then he preached Sri Vaishnavism. Of course, he had his own other inspirational gurus like Kanchipurna and then Yamunacharya and others also. But Yadav Prakash was his official guru. Similarly, Madhvacharya, who was his official guru? Achyut Preksha. Who was he? A Mayavadi. So, Mayavad in traditional India had a hold on Indian society that is stronger than the hold of modern science and modern society. So, you just couldn't go against Mayavad directly. So, all the chief priests in India were Mayavadis. So, all the main religious leaders were Mayavadis. So, what they did was, everybody, if it is Madhva Sampradaya or Sri Sampradaya, they took initiation in the Mayavad Sampradaya, but then they preached Vaishnavism. So, as far as a great Acharya is concerned, now Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is not just a great Acharya, he is the Supreme Lord. Great Acharyas can take initiation in a particular path, but then they can preach a higher or more complete Siddhanta. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took initiation in the Madhva Sampradaya in the sense that Ishwarapuri, Madhavendrapuri, if you go backwards, then he is connected to Madhva Sampradaya. But then he preached not Dvaitavad. He taught Achintya Bheda Veda. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also took sannyas from the Advaita Sampradaya so that his sannyas would have respectability. So in this way, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in order to gain respectability for his teachings and for his teachers of sannyas, he took sannyas and he took diksha and sannyas from different places. But the teachings that he gave are actually a synthesis that takes the teachings to a higher level. So he takes the best points of all the sampradayas and he gives an integrated teaching. So in that sense, we officially belong to Madhva Sampradaya, but actually there are differences. There are significant differences in our philosophy from Madhva's philosophy. And in fact, Madhva's philosophy is quite different from all other Vaishnava philosophies also. Our philosophy is the closest to Sri Vaishnavism. Sri Vaishnavism is propagated by Ramanujacharya and then it has been going on after that. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took initiation. So, our connection with Madhva Sampradaya is official. It is not theological or doctrinal. Doctrinally, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us a higher, more enriched understanding of the Vedic Siddhanta. Okay? Yes, ma'am. How do the Madhvas and Sri Vaishnavas look upon Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? They treat him as a great saint. They recognize that he propagated bhakti far and wide, and they appreciate his teachings. And it's perfectly understandable that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's divinity may not be accepted by everyone, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Channa Avatar. And even in his time, not everybody accepted his divinity. And that is not wrong, as long as they are also on the Vaishnava path. They accept him as a great saint. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur also talks very beautifully in his, you know, that book which he wrote, which he sent to America, Life and Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So there, in that essay, towards the end, he writes that, you know, he describes many of the miracles that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performed also, how he gave mystical vision, how he had his ecstatic chanting. And then at the end, he says that we leave, maybe I can read it out. Data card is not here. It's there on my website. Anyway, okay. So basically what he says is that we leave the decision about the divinity of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to our readers. As far as the Vaishnavas are concerned, they accept Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as God. And they see the his miracles as expressions of his divinity. But neither the miracles nor the divinity is most important. Most important is the message of overwhelming love that he has given. Because there are many people who have claimed to be divine, and miracles have been performed even by demons. But if one understands the spirit of Lord Chaitanya's teachings and experiences the love that he has come to offer, that is the greatest gift of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And we hope our readers will not reject this gift. Very beautiful, very sweetly he ends it. So, he doesn't impose the divinity of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, the other Vaishnavas, they treat him as a great saint. How do ISKCON look upon Madhvas? How do Madhvas look upon ISKCON? Okay. See, generally everybody has their individual leaders. There are 8 matas. So all of them have their individual stands. Not, they don't have a unified stand. The Pejavar Swami is very appreciative and respectful of ISKCON. And there are some others also who are respectful. But there are some others who are a little disturbed. There are some people who are responsible for that. One of them is our Vrajbihari Prabhu. The Vrajbihari Prabhu is a brahmachari in Chaupati temple. And what happened is that he was born in a Madhva family in Udupi. And he became a brahmachari in ISKCON. So some Madhva leaders got upset by that. And some of them came together and they said that, you know, we have been battling with Shankara's Advaita Vad for 700-800 years. And practically none of our younger generation has ever become an Advaita Vadi. But this ISKCON has existed only for 30-40 years, and so many of our young people are going to ISKCON. Therefore, ISKCON is a greater danger to us than Advaita Vad. They got a little upset, but then our devotees went and talked with him. See, what happens is, our devotees are also immature. Some devotees went there and they challenged, why don't you accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as God? But that is the last thing we should ask them. You know, see, whenever we are talking with other Vaishnavas at least, if we see how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu deals with it. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, he has Murari Gupta, he respects his Rama Bhakti. And similarly, we have Anupam, his Rama Bhakti is glorified. So now, if we see, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu goes on South India tour, it's one Ram Bhakta who is separating from mother, feeling separation from Mother Sita. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu goes out of his way to give him the Kurma Pranam to talk about, which talks about Maya Sita and Rishyosin. There's another Ram Bhakta who on his Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's return journey is chanting Krishna's names. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is actually that way quite broad. He doesn't necessarily impose Krishna, Gaudiya Vaishnavism on everyone. Of course, there's one thing that neither Murari Gupta nor Anupam, Murari Gupta never became an initiating spiritual master in our sampradaya. The initiating spiritual masters in our sampradaya are those who are Krishna Bhaktas in the Gaudiya understanding. Murari Gupta is accepted as a great Vaishnava, and he is also written a biography of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is also recognized. So, our understanding is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu illustrates his example. Who are the primary gurus since Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? If you see, there is the branches which are described in the branches of the Chaitanya tree. So he described Advaita Acharya and his expansion, Nityananda Prabhu and his expansion, and Gadadhar Pandita and his expansions. So these three were the primary spiritual masters coming down from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time. That's chapters 11 and 12, I think. Chapters 11 and 12 of Adilya Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's example teaches us that if somebody is having some other attraction to some other forms of Vishnu and some other understanding of Vaishnavism, we don't forcibly try to convert them. But then we don't propagate that understanding. So we propagate Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but we respect other branches of Vaishnavism also. Bhakti Sanskrit Thakur tried quite a bit to unify all the four sampradayas. And that's why he had that symbol of four sampradayas on Gaudiya Math also. So the point is that we were immature initially, and some of our devotees went and challenged them. Why don't you accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as God? Now they are Sanskrit pandits. And you can't, our ISKCON devotees who know barely a little bit Sanskrit, you can't go and debate with them. We need a caliber of somebody of Jiva Goswami to explain the various verses which are there, which talk about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's divinity, and to debate. So unnecessarily we antagonized them. And now gradually, what happened was that ISKCON says we are in the Madhava Sampradaya. And then there was a meeting of this Udupi Mathas, and they said, you know, is ISKCON Madhava Sampradaya or not? We have to decide that. So they said that actually, you know, it will add to the prestige of Madhava Sampradaya if we have an organization that has branches all over the world, that belongs to Madhava Sampradaya. Isn't it? So, then when this argument was presented and all the objections, you know, this thing, that thing, they said, yes, you are also Madhava Sampradaya. Come on. So it's like that. So, doctrinally, we are different. But officially, we are connected. Okay?
Perfection and realization.
Not now. Certainly not in the evening when everybody is waiting for the class to be over. Not at that time. Maybe some other time. Let's see how we go forward. It is a technical subject. Because you know, even within sampradayas, the differences and similarities are subtle. So the most important thing is the whole concept of Madhurya Ras. That is the distinctive contribution of Gaudiya Sampradaya. You know, what is that song? Gaudiya Gaurana Haite. So that, you know, the love of Radharani and the gopis, that clear understanding of the exalted nature of that love, that is the distinctively unique contribution of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. There is to some extent understanding that there is a conjugal relationship. Lakshmi Narayan have conjugal relationship, Sitaram have conjugal relationship. But the exalted nature of that relationship and the details of the various mellows in that relationship, that is unique contribution of Gaudiya Vaishnavism.
Proji, in Shastra it is said deity is made up of five elements, but we see Prabhupada deity is made up of some other material, and we don't offer bhoga to Prabhupada deities. I mean, so is it as equally worshipped as Radha Kunj Bihari or?
Yeah, now there are certain lists, it's not five, it's eight elements. It's talking about 11th canto of the material that can be made deity, but that is not an exhaustive list, that is an indicative list. And there can be many other materials also from which deities can be made. The important point is that the deity has to be made in a shape according to scripture. And the mudras and the roop and then pranapatishtha has to be performed and seva has to be done with bhakti. So we have deities which are often made of plaster of Paris. And Srila Prabhupada was himself asked just before he departed whether we can make your deities. Prabhupada said yes. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur deities were also made. So you can make. And then, in general, how it works is when Srila Prabhupada was present on the planet. Now, you would not offer bhoga to him. You offer bhoga to Krishna, and Prabhupada would also take prasad like everyone else. So that's why there is no separate, normally, there is no separate bhoga offered to Prabhupada. If there is no, if it's a samadhi mandir of Prabhupada, where Prabhupada is the primary deity, that's a different issue. But if it's a temple, when there is the main deity, and Prabhupada is also, in one sense, beholding the beauty of that deity, serving that deity, then Prabhupada is not offered separate bhoga except on special days like appearance and disappearance. But if we have Samadhi Mandir of Prabhupada, then there is separate bhoga which is offered to Prabhupada also. So the materials is not exhaustive list, what is given in the Bhagavad. Other materials can also be used. So there is a whole category of literature which are also smriti, they are called pancharatras. So Narad Pancharatra is one pancharatra, but there are many other pancharatra literature like that. And they all talk about the various rules of deity worship.
Also, we have spiritual master's lamination to which we offer before offering to Kunjbihari. So, while spiritual master is physically present, can he also accepting our offerings through his laminations? Or how to understand this phenomenon?
See, when the spiritual master is present on the planet, is he accepting our offerings? In general, the spiritual master or Srila Prabhupada never claimed to be omnipotent or omnipresent. It's not that the spiritual master is present everywhere. But at the same time, the spiritual master is intimately connected with Krishna. And in mood, our offering is done through the spiritual master. That's why we have the photo of the spiritual master. And now the spiritual master doesn't have to be consciously conscious. That means he doesn't have to be aware that this disciple is doing this disciple is offering bhoga to me and this and that. He doesn't have to be aware. Because the spiritual master is also a jiva who has taken up the responsibility of sharing Krishna's message. Spiritual master does not necessarily have omniscience. He doesn't know everything. But the principle is, the principle that our connection with Krishna is through the spiritual master. So that is expressed through the point that we offer our bhoga through the spiritual master. So we are not offering to the spiritual master, we are offering through the spiritual master to Krishna. The spiritual master is our connection through the parampara, and the parampara is our connection to Krishna. Last question.
On a special occasion like this, for instance, appearance, right, we directly offer to bhoga to spiritual master. So someone may ask, ki how you are directly offering, why not first offering to Krishna, then later on you are giving to.
Correct. So why do we offer to the spiritual master directly on his appearance or disappearance days? See, in principle, even if Prabhupada is going to take bhoga, he will offer to Krishna and take. Prabhupada will not take anything himself directly. But the principle is that there are certain occasions like Vyas Puja. So on Vyas Puja day, you know, we glorify the spiritual master. Because that is a way of expressing our affection. Or of expressing our love, our gratitude to the spiritual master for what he has given us. So just as when the spiritual master is manifest on this planet, at that time, so normally the spiritual master also wants us to glorify Krishna. And our normal duty is to glorify Krishna. One time one devotee asked the Prabhupada. Prabhupada, we say that Chaitanya Gauranitai are more merciful than Chaitanya and Lord Krishna. So Chaitanya Gauranitai's names is more beautiful, better than chanting Lord Krishna's names. And Prabhupada, you are more merciful than Lord Chaitanya. Therefore chanting your names will be more merciful. So can we chant 16 rounds of your names? So Prabhupada said, don't concoct. Chant Hare Krishna. So the principle of mercy is there. But still the process, that doesn't mean that you change the process. So similarly, the point is that in general, the spiritual master also teaches to glorify Krishna. But on Vyas Puja day, we glorify directly the spiritual master. So like that, on the day of appearance or disappearance of the spiritual master, we express our affection and gratitude to the spiritual master by offering bhoga directly to him. Just as the spiritual master, if he is present and is accepting the glorification of the disciple, he is actually offering it to his spiritual master and to Krishna. So similarly, the bhoga is also the same principle. So on that particular day, we offer it directly to the spiritual master to express our affection. Okay? So thank you very much. Shri Shok Nishad ki, Shri Prabhupad ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Gaur Premanandai. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.